Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by The Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. My normal partner, Elliot Cohen, is traveling in Israel today, but we have a very special guest on Shield of the Republic, my former colleague in government, my distinguished former colleague in government, John Bolton, former Assistant Secretary for International Organization Affairs at the Department of State, former Undersecretary for Arms Control and Technology in the Bush 43 administration, and then Ambassador to the United Nations, the author of Surrender is Not an Option and The Room Where It Happened. John, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Glad to be with you.
Like, I know you've been very busy and on the airwaves today. We're recording on November the 4th, right before the election. I will not ask you to predict the outcome, nor will I ask you what you've been asked multiple times, which is why you believe Donald J. Trump is unfit to be president of the United States. But I do want to ask you, based on your time with him as national security advisor in the Trump administration, what do you think makes him so susceptible to the sort of appeals of people like Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and Kim Jong-un?
Well, you know, he doesn't have any kind of philosophy about national security or anything else that I can think of. He certainly doesn't have a grand strategy. He doesn't even do policy in the way we understand that term in Washington. He approaches pretty much everything on a transactional, ad hoc basis. I think he sees things through the prism of how his decisions affect him and whether they benefit him. He can't tell the difference between his own personal interest and the national interest, if he even understands what the national interest is. He believes and has said publicly that he thinks if he has good relations with a foreign head of state, then U.S. relations with that foreign state are good, as if the likes of Putin and Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un are affected by that kind of personal consideration. I think these leaders, after the first term, have had a chance to study Trump in operation. I think they know how susceptible he is to flattery. And I think they believe he will be an easy mark.
What do you make of the public, constant public adulation he gives them at his rallies, talking about Xi Jinping, governing China with strength? I mean, some of us might say governing, China, committing genocide and running a totalitarian state. But, all of them he praises, he singles out for praise. Why does he do that? And to whom in the American electorate do you think he's appealing with those kinds of statements?
This is a subject on which a lot of people have commented. Many of them are shrinks or wannabe shrinks. They've got psychological reasons that explain it. I don't pretend to understand that realm. I do think he envisions himself as a big guy, a big tough guy. He likes other big tough guys. He listens to Putin. He listens to Xi. He listens to how they talk about governing, unburdened by uncooperative legislatures, unconcerned with what the judiciary may do. And he thinks to himself, why can't I do that? This doesn't amount to being a fascist, in my view, having a theory of how you want to govern. It's just, why can't I have the same fun they have? And it leaves him vulnerable to the kind of cajoling that I think they're listing of that they're going to try on him as soon as he's sworn in, if he prevails. What does he think it benefits him domestically? I think it's part of the I alone can fix it mentality. He first said that it is acceptance speech in 2016. And I remember thinking at the time, this is not a good sign to say I alone can fix it. But he said in this campaign, if he had been president, Russia would not have invaded Ukraine. There would not have been a war in the Middle East. And he'll fix both of them within 24 hours. This is delusional, but very typical of the way Trump looks at the world.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what happens after tomorrow under either possible outcome. I start with Trump. One thing many people have commented on was that in the first term, there were adults in the room where it happened. Rex Tillerson, H.R. McMaster, you, Jim Mattis, Mark Esper. Clearly, that will not be the case next time around. You're not going to have more traditional Reaganite Republican conservatives around Trump. Just starting from the beginning, how would you expect his administration to be populated at the senior levels?
Look, I think the questions that are the top of the interview list that he clearly applied to J.D. Vance to make him his vice presidential nominee are, number one, do you think the 2020 election was stolen? Correct answer is yes. Saying no probably is disqualifying. And then second, if I told you to do what I told Mike Pence to do on January the 6th, would you do it? Correct answer is yes. Disqualifying answer is no. And what this means is a kind of loyalty to Trump above and beyond loyalty to the Constitution and the country. Look, loyalty is a good thing in administration. You want people who are working together. It's not a question of being disloyal when you offer an alternative point of view. Quite the contrary. I think one job of the National Security Advisor is to make sure the president has all the information he needs, knows what the options are, and then he'll make the decision. Trump couldn't care less about that. Information is not important to him. He doesn't absorb it, as I think HR found out to his dismay. And he doesn't particularly listen to the options. He makes up his mind, and then he wants to act on it. So I'll give you two quick examples of what will be wrong, potentially, in a second Trump term. Robert O'Brien, my successor, said publicly, I think, back when he was still in office, that over a given weekend, he'd collect Trump's tweets about international affairs, and opening the NSC staff meeting on Monday, he'd say, here are the new policy declarations. Let's figure out how to implement them. I would take the tweets in and think to myself, what does the president need to know to get him to reconsider some of these ill-considered statements? That's not trying to undermine the president. It's trying to make sure that he's well informed when he makes the decisions he's entitled to make. And the second example, I wrote this in my book, in the NATO summit meeting in Brussels in 2018, where Trump came within a hair's breadth of withdrawing from NATO. Mike Pompeo were with Trump in the ambassador's residence before we went over to the fateful meeting. And we were discussing why Pompeo and I thought it was a bad idea to withdraw. And at one point, Trump turned to me and said, I knew I should have made Keith Kellogg my national security advisor. Keith only tells me his opinion when I ask for it. As I like to say, I was the national security advisor. I was not the national security decision maker. A president benefits from hearing the natural disagreements among his staff. It makes for better policy to have full discussion. That in no way undercuts the president's ability to fulfill his legitimate constitutional function of being the president.
I want to ask you, I have never met Trump, never spoken with him. So everything I, know about him is at one remove, including from reading books like yours and others about people who have served under him. I have a sense that the public may not even know how little he actually knows or understands about international affairs, about the workings of government. He is the only president who was elected without significant government or military experience in our history. But I know that there's one example of you trying to brief him before one of his summits with Kim Jong-un about the Libya nuclear deal in 2003. But he wasn't even able to take on the information because all he could think about was Gaddafi being overthrown by an international coalition some 10 years later. So am I right that he just lacks fundamental understanding of the major issues and how international affairs actually work?
Yeah, he has basically almost no history in his mind. He once asked John Kelly, before I arrived on the scene, is Finland still part of Russia? So when you have that kind of question, it's hard to know where to begin to help give him the knowledge he needs. We had a meeting with Theresa May at Checkers right after this famous NATO summit, and we were discussing a number of things when the subject of the Russian chemical attack on the Skripals, two Russian exiles, dissidents, and my opposite number said, you know, this was serious. This was a chemical weapons attack on a nuclear power, meaning the United Kingdom. And Trump looked at Theresa May and said, oh, do you have nuclear weapons? I mean, I didn't know what to say. This was 18 months after he had taken office, and he didn't apparently know that the Brits were one of the nuclear weapon states. Going back to what I said a moment ago about this idea that relations depend on the personal relationships between leaders, Trump had a theory that he could size somebody up in a minute or maybe less, the first time they meet somebody. One of these has to do with your probable success with a member of the fair sex when you meet them for the first time, which weighed heavily on his mind. If you really believe that, then you don't need to know any history. You don't need to know what the stakes are. You don't need to know what the issues are. I briefed Trump before his summit with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki on strategic weapons issues, sitting on Air Force One, traveling between Scotland and Finland during a FIFA World Cup soccer match. That was the briefing that we used. And the most appealing argument to him was had to do with the politics of the Senate ratifying the New START treaty, where 2/3 of the Republicans opposed it. That was my best argument as to why New START was not a good idea. Forget the strategic weapons questions. That's the only thing that interested him. And that's not untypical, because you're dealing with the question then, how does this hurt or benefit Trump politically, depending on what position he takes?
You raised the interview with J.D. Vance, and I wanted to come back to Vance and his role. I mean, I find it very troubling, of course, that he was selected among all the potential vice presidential nominees that Trump had at his disposal, in part because Vance also lacks government experience. He's been in the Senate for all of 18 months. But also because of his explicit espousal of an America First ideology that is opposed to U.S. leadership and engagement in the world, he famously said he doesn't care what happens to Ukraine. He wants to end the so-called endless wars that the United States has been in since 2001. I worry about what this means, even if Trump loses in the election tomorrow, what this augurs for the future of the Republican Party and for the Reaganite peace through strength foreign policy I think both you and I espouse. How should I think about that? What should I make of the Vance selection, and what role do you think he'll play in the future, even if Trump loses?
Well, I think it was a very disturbing selection. I have to say, Trump did something I predicted he would not do, and I think, in effect, he named an heir apparent. He did it at a time he thought he'd be running against Joe Biden, so he didn't need to balance the ticket or anything like that. He thought he was a sure winner. I thought Trump would never pick an heir apparent, because once you do that, maybe the guy who picked him becomes surplus to requirements and is not so necessary. But now he's stuck with him, and we'll see what happens on Tuesday. I think the fight for the soul of the Republican Party on national security begins on Wednesday anyway, whether we win or lose. It'll be a different fight if Trump's in office, obviously, than if he's not. But this virus of isolationism is unquestionably loose in the party again. A good part of it is caused by Trump, but there are other factors as well, and Vance is a piece of evidence for that. I think he's much smarter than Trump, and I think he's glib, as are a number of others of that view. They don't know much about international affairs, but it doesn't slow them down in voicing opinions. And because they think about it more systematically, they're able to produce arguments that are more appealing and more internally coherent than what Trump says about it. So Trump may disappear tomorrow, but the problem of isolationism is not going to go away. And I think one of the reasons it's returned is goes back to the end of the Cold War. I think some people were talking about the end of history. There were no more threats in the world. Democracy and free markets had triumphed. It was the economy, stupid. Globalism would take care of everything. Well, that was wrong then, but to a certain extent, we all succumbed to it. And we've lost, if you think about it now, 30 plus years of American leaders looking at the world and making a strategic analysis and then making the case to the American people to deal with these threats. Here are the steps we're going to have to take, increase defense expenditures, whatever it may be, to get public support for the kind of peace through strength approach that Reagan tried to follow. You can't assume people are going to back it automatically, but the fact is we've lost a lot of built up capital over these three decades that the neo-isolationists are taking advantage of. So part of it is on us, and it really is the Reaganites, if you want to call them that, but what I would call a traditional conservative foreign policy, not neo-conservative, but just a traditional American conservative view, we've got to do more homework and we've got to do more proselytizing. This game is not going to fall to us by default.
I mean, another troubling element that at least troubles me has been the growing influence during the course of this campaign of Elon Musk on Trump. This is someone who has major business interests in China, who runs one of the most important kind of information technology platforms in the world, who runs a SpaceX, which the United States Department of Defense depends extremely heavily for satellite launch, and who also appears to have had a ongoing, personal, relationship of some kind with Vladimir Putin, all of which, I find extremely troubling, particularly if he ends up having some kind of, even not official, but some unofficial advisory role in a second term. Do you find that troubling as well? I mean, I think if you or I had multiple conversations with Vladimir Putin, we might have had a knock on our door from the FBI, asking us a few questions about our security clearances.
Right. Well, I think this the attraction that Trump has here has to do with what Trump sees as the political benefit to him. Forget about the national interest. He sees Musk, obviously proprietor of what used to be called Twitter, X now, a hugely successful entrepreneur, very wealthy man with access to a lot of communications and money that can help in his campaign, that is helping in the campaign right now. And he's just playing for it. He's just offering support. It's a straight out transaction without anybody bothering to consider what consequences there might be because of Musk's business dealings. But it's not untypical. Trump during his first term was very, very strongly against cryptocurrency. I mean, he used to tell Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, all the time, you need to protect the currency and eliminate this cryptocurrency. Trump, because of the Chinese ownership of TikTok, was against it until a major contributor who happens to be a big owner of it came on board his campaign. This isn't the basis of a philosophy that Trump has. It's just entirely transactional. I don't know what Musk is up to. He may be just as cynically transactional as Trump is. I suspect that may be right. But he has the prospect, along with a lot of other sketchy people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who in his latest font of wisdom said he was going to advocate eliminating the fluoridation of water in American the American water supply. Somebody should ask if he thinks it was a communist conspiracy that put it there to begin with. This is what you get in a Trump administration. It's just a crazy mixture of individual transactions, one by one, which benefit Trump and maybe some of the people he's dealing with, without any consideration of their larger implications. Musk may be a brilliant entrepreneur. You can't deny that. That doesn't mean he's a good advisor in a government context or necessarily even a safe advisor.
What do you think? I mean, Vance just gave an interview in which he said the first things Trump will do if he's elected will be executive orders to close the border and deal with immigration. And then the next thing he said would be to make a deal on Ukraine with Russia to end the war. You started out our discussion saying this was kind of delusional, that he thinks he could, you know, stop this. What do you anticipate he would do? What would be the opening moves you would expect to see in a Trump administration? And what are the things you fear most he might do over a 4-year term? And then I promise you we'll turn to the other alternative and discuss what might be wrong with that.
Well, I think there are any number of risks in a Trump second term, starting with China. If he thought he could make what he always used to call the biggest trade deal in history with China, he would do it in a heartbeat. He doesn't understand the strategic threat. He's tough on China rhetorically now because he thinks COVID cost him the 2020 election. He's probably right about that. Of course, he didn't actually lose. It was stolen. But if it hadn't been stolen, it would have been China's fault.
I think you mean in his mind, it was stolen.
That's right. That's right. He could change on a dime if Xi Jinping called him the day after the election and said, Donald, I'm so glad you got elected. Biden was a disaster. He's caused so many problems. Let's get together. Trump would take him up on a heartbeat. I think the risk of withdrawal from NATO is very real. I think a lot of our friends in the Republican Party are rationalizing today, saying he's not really going to do it. He's not really going to do it. Take my word for it. In the summer of 2018, it almost happened. And only because he was distracted subsequently, I think, didn't it happen. In Ukraine, look, if he did what he said he wanted to do, get Zelensky and Putin in a room together to solve it in 24 hours, by perhaps putting pressure on both sides, saying to Zelensky, you make a deal or we're going to cut your aid off, and saying to Putin, you're going to feel our force if you don't make a deal, would not result in a deal in 24 hours. That would be failure. Donald Trump never fails. Therefore, the responsibility for the failure is either Zelensky's or Putin's. I wouldn't bet any money on Zelensky being the guy not at fault in that conversation. And if the threat is to cut off assistance, that's music to Putin's ears. So I'm very worried about Ukraine. I'm worried about our alliances, NATO in particular, of course, but generally Trump doesn't understand what a collective defense alliance is. I mean, he basically, this is not an oversimplification. He thinks we're defending all these people and they're not paying us enough. You know, it's purely transactional. He doesn't think we get any benefit out of it. Are there problems with the NATO alliance? Of course there were. Remember Henry Kissinger's book from the 1960s called The Troubled Partnership. I mean, that was 60 years ago. You know, you've got to work on alliances. Trump doesn't want to do that. So the amount of damage he could cause in a second term, particularly if he's got people whose task is to come into his presence every morning and hear his orders and carry them out, that's real trouble.
Well, let's turn to the other potential possibility, which is a Kamala Harris victory, which at least as we sit here today, some of the polls suggest maybe a little bit more likely than we might have thought 72 or 96 hours ago. She's talked a lot about peace through strength. She talked about maintaining, the most lethal and agile military in the world. What do you anticipate from a Harris administration? Just a straight on continuation of Biden, or are we likely to see some changes in your view?
Well, I'd like to find out who in the Democratic Party wrote those lines for. I wasn't sure there was anybody left in that party who could do that. You know, I do think, given her lack of national security experience before she became vice president, that everything she's picked up has been by osmosis during the last nearly 4 years. And I would hope she's learned a lot. She's going to need it. On-the-job training as president's not the best place to learn how to do national security. But I don't see any indication for some substantial period of time, let's say a year, maybe a year and a half, where what she decides looks a lot different than what a Biden second term would look like. I do believe that she will get an entirely new team of advisors. I think very few of the Biden team will remain, at least in their current positions. I don't have any indication it will be people with radically different points of view. I think it'll come from the Democratic establishment, people who have been with Biden, with Obama, with Clinton before that. but there'll be different people and new challenges, new threats will arise, and her policy will evolve. But I'm not aware of any reason to think that on January the 21st, things are going to start looking much different from where they were on January 19th next year.
I mean, one thing a Harris administration would, I think, undoubtedly be dealing with is a deteriorating battlefield situation in Ukraine, which is not going very well. Do you think there might be a relook at some of the restrictions we've put on the Ukrainians in terms of being able to strike at Russian targets? How will she deal with the question of trying to bring an end to the conflict, since right now it doesn't look like there's any negotiated outcome that is possible? How do you think she might deal with it? I mean, she's got some sunk costs here because of the Biden commitment to see that Russia fails, quote unquote.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of the basic problem. The Biden administration doesn't want to see Ukraine lose, but they also don't want to see it win, because we've been deterred by the Russians. We failed to deter the aggression, but in the conduct of the war, we've been deterred by the fear of a wider war. I mean, I don't know where Putin's going to find the troops to fight the wider war. Maybe he just found them in North Korea. Which certainly is a new reality for everybody. But other than that, if he had another army hidden somewhere, you'd think he'd put it in Ukraine to begin with to make up for the pitiful performance of the existing forces. I just think the lack of an overall strategic framework to the levels of assistance we've provided, and which by being absent has contributed to the gridlock, would probably continue. I am worried that resolve in Europe is close to collapse. I don't have much confidence that the Starmer government in Britain will be as robust as the Conservative Party governments. Macron in France is deeply underwater in terms of domestic popularity. The German coalition hasn't collapsed only because it would be an electoral wipeout for every member of it if they had to go to the people. So I don't see strong leaders in Europe to keep things moving, and a weak Harris team that may think it's better to cut their losses and get to the negotiating table sooner. I don't think it will be as bad as what Trump would do, but I don't have a good feeling about it.
What would be your biggest fear about a Harris administration, you know, at least in the first, you know, year, 18 months?
Well, if the prediction that it looks a lot like Biden comes to pass, you know, the central failure, I think, on China policy was the idea that climate change was somehow the biggest issue we had. And if John Kerry had only succeeded after 4 years of trying of making a climate change deal with China, sweetness and light would have broken out. I think the Chinese are still scratching their heads saying, what were these people thinking about? They're happy to discuss climate change infinitely. In the meantime, if you look at what they've been doing now, not just with respect to Taiwan or the Senkakus, but in recent weeks, they've intervened in Japanese airspace and the maritime domain. They're pressing all along the first island chain, obviously continuing to weaponize the South China Sea. They've made a deal with India, interestingly, about the line of control between those two countries. I think maybe buying a little stability over there in the short term so that they can have a freer hand in East and Southeast Asia. I think the Biden people have done some positive things. I think the AUKUS deal is a good deal. I think the trilateral agreement with Japan and South Korea on joint military exercises could be important. I think the Asia Quad, pushing that forward, is a plus. But does Kamala Harris have a larger vision for how to handle all this? I'm very worried that she doesn't. And if climate change is her biggest priority, maybe she'll make Tony Blinken the climate change negotiator with China. And we'll see more of that for 4 years.
So I know we're running short on time because you have a busy day and busy schedule. So let me close by asking you this. Regardless of who wins on Tuesday, what do you think the two or three biggest national security challenges the next administration will face will be?
Well, I think probably overall the biggest problem is that we have for 30 years allowed our defense capacity to atrophy. We need major increases in defense spending. I mean, my prediction is to go from roughly 3% of GDP up to Reagan era levels, 4%, 5%, 6%. I'm a budget hawk. If you increase defense, you're going to have to cut domestic spending to get the deficit down, to get the national debt down. No politician likes to hear that. I think that's the reality. That's going to be the hardest issue overall. We have to be more prepared. I think the war in Ukraine has demonstrated that. We've got to build up our capacity across all the services, number one. Number two, I think we've got to come to grips with the China-Russia axis. You know, a year ago, that was just a kind of a hypothesis. It's almost conventional wisdom today. But we still don't have a strategy to deal with what is effectively a global opposition, not just a separate war in Europe, a separate conflict in the Middle East, separate threats in Asia. These are all going to be together in some way or another. And I think finally, I am very worried that we've just turned our attention away from the terrorist threat completely. Even as this catastrophic decision to withdraw from Afghanistan, implemented poorly by the Biden administration, but coming from Donald Trump personally, has left us more exposed. We've seen ISIS-K attacks in Iran, in Russia, none yet in the U.S. or Western Europe, but they're not far away. That's just on top of all the other threats we've got of nuclear proliferation and in this hemisphere from Cuba and Venezuela. The threat spectrum against the United States is filling up across the board. We haven't talked about cyberspace. We haven't talked about asymmetric warfare, gray zone warfare. I mean, there are a lot of challenges. And look at this just concluded presidential campaign. Very, very little discussion of national security. We're electing a president with life and death authority, and we barely know what to expect.
Well, John, thank you. You've been very generous with your time. I think given the agenda you just sketched out, you know, no matter who wins, we'll have a lot to talk about. And hopefully after Elliot returns from his travels, at some point in the future, we can get you back on Shield of the Republic and you can grade out whoever actually ends up inheriting this mess.
I would look forward to it. Thank you for having me.